the occasional need for committing to a hard date. We address this with the concept of high-integrity commitments, used for those situations where we need to commit to a date or a specific deliverable. There are several benefits to this way of working. First, the teams are much more motivated when they're free to solve the problem the best way they see fit. It's the missionary versus mercenary thing again. Moreover, the teams are designed to be in the best position to solve these problems. Second, the team is not off the hook just by delivering a requested feature or project. The feature must solve the business problem as measured by the key results. Otherwise, the team needs to try to find a different approach to the solution. Third, no matter where the idea for the solution comes from or how smart that person is, very often the initial approach doesn't work out. Rather than pretending this is not the case, this model embraces that likelihood. It's all about outcome rather than output. There are a few product teams out there that have modified their product roadmaps so that each item is stated as a business problem to solve rather than the feature or project that may or may not solve it. These are called outcome-based roadmaps. In general, when I see these, I'm pretty happy because I know the product teams are stepping up to solving business problems rather than build features. Outcome-based roadmaps are essentially equivalent to using a business objective-based system such as the OKR system. It's the format that's different more than the content. There is a tendency, however, with outcome-based roadmaps to put a deadline date on every item rather than only on the items with a true date constraint. This practice can have cultural and motivation implications to the team. High-integrity commitments. In most Agile teams, when you even mention the word commitments, like knowing what you're going to launch and when it will happen, you get reactions ranging from squirming to denial. It's a constant struggle between those executives and stakeholders who are trying to run the business with hiring plans, marketing program spend, partnerships, and contracts depending on specific dates and deliverables, and the product team that is understandably reluctant to commit to dates and deliverables. They're reluctant when they don't yet understand what they need to deliver and if it will work in terms of delivering the necessary business results, in addition to not knowing how much it will really cost because they don't yet know the solution. Underlying all of this is the hard-learned lessons of product teams that many of the ideas won't work as we had hoped, and those that could work will typically take several iterations to get to the point where they move the needle enough to be considered a business success. In a custom software environment, you might just be able to iterate until the business is satisfied with the software, or they just give up on it. In a product company, this won't fly. Now, don't get me wrong. You've just heard how I feel about the perils of conventional roadmaps. Good product companies minimize these commitments, but there are always some real commitments that need to be made in order to effectively run a company. So what to do? The key is to understand that the root cause of all this grief about commitments is when these commitments are made. They are made too early. They are made before we know whether we can deliver on this obligation, and even more important, whether what we deliver will solve the problem for the customer. In the continuous discovery and delivery model, the discovery work is all about answering these questions before we spend the time and money to build production quality products. So, the way we manage commitments is with a little bit of give and take. We ask the executives and our other stakeholders to give us a little time in product discovery to investigate the necessary solution. We need the time to validate that solution with customers to ensure it has the necessary value and usability, with engineers to ensure its feasibility, and with our stakeholders to ensure it's viable for our business. Once we have come up with a solution that works for our business, we can now make an informed and high-integrity commitment about when we can deliver and what business results we can expect. Note that our delivery managers are key to determining any commitment dates. Just because your engineers believe something might take only 2 weeks to build and deliver, what if that team is already occupied on other work and they can't start on this work for another month? The delivery managers track these commitments and dependencies. So the compromise is straightforward. The product team asks for a little time to do product discovery before commitments are made, and then after discovery, we are willing to commit to dates and deliverables so our colleagues can effectively do their jobs as well. Again, in good companies, these types of commitments are minimized, but there are always some. It's important for the organization to get comfortable with making these high-integrity commitments and explain to the company that, while they're not something we do frequently, when we do them, they can depend on the product team delivering on these commitments. Chapter 24, Product Vision and Product Strategy. The Product Vision. The product vision describes the future we are trying to create, typically somewhere between 2 and 5 years out. For hardware or device-centric companies, it's usually 5 to 10 years out. Note that this is not the same as the company mission statement. Examples of mission statements are organize the world's information, or make the world more open and connected, or enable anyone anywhere to buy anything anytime. Mission statements are useful, but they don't say anything about how we plan on accomplishing that. That's what the product vision's for. Note also that the vision is not in any sense a spec. It's mainly a persuasive piece that might be in the form of a storyboard, a narrative such as a white paper, or a special type of prototype referred to as a vision type. Its primary purpose is to communicate this vision and inspire the teams and stakeholders, investors, partners, and in many cases, prospective customers to want to help make this vision a reality.
When done well, the product vision is one of our most effective recruiting tools, and it serves to motivate the people on your teams to come to work every day.
Strong technology people are drawn to an inspiring vision. They want to work on something meaningful. You can do some amount of testing of the vision, but it's not the same as the testing of specific solutions we do in product discovery. In truth, buying into a vision is always a bit of a leap of faith. You likely don't know how or even if you'll be able to deliver on the vision. But remember, you have several years to discover the solutions. At this stage, you should believe it's a worthwhile pursuit. The product strategy. One of the most basic of all product lessons learned is that trying to please everybody at once will almost certainly please nobody. So the last thing we should do is embark on a ginormous, multi-year effort to create a release that tries to deliver on the product vision. The product strategy is our sequence of products or releases we plan to deliver on the path to realizing the product vision. I'm using the phrase products or releases here loosely. It might be different versions of the same product, a series of different or related products, or some other set of meaningful milestones. For most types of businesses, I encourage teams to construct product strategy around a series of product market fits. There are many variations on this, the strategy for the product strategy, if you will. For business-focused companies, you might have each product market fit focus on a different vertical market. For example, financial services, manufacturing, automotive. For consumer-focused companies, we often structure each product market fit around a different customer or user persona. For example, an education-related service might have a strategy that targets high school students first, college students next, and then those already working but who want to learn new skills. Sometimes the product strategy is based on geography, where we tackle different regions of the world in an intentional sequence. And sometimes the product strategy is based on achieving a set of key milestones in some sort of logical and important order. For example, first deliver critical rating and reviews functionality to developers building e-commerce applications. Next, leverage the data generated from this use to create a database of consumer product sentiment, and then leverage these data for advanced product recommendations. There's no single approach to product strategy that is ideal for everyone, and you can never know how things might have gone if you sequenced your product work differently. I tell teams that the most important benefit is just that you decided to focus your product work on a single target market at a time. So, all teams know we're tackling the manufacturing market now, and that's the type of customers we are obsessing on. Our goal is to come up with the smallest actual deliverable product that makes these manufacturing customers successful. Ideas that come up that pertain to other types of customers or markets are saved for future consideration. Besides significantly increasing your chance of delivering something that can power your business, the product strategy now gives you a tool to align your product work with your sales and marketing organizations. We want the sales organization to sell in the markets where we've demonstrated product market fit. As soon as we demonstrate product market fit for a new market, usually by developing an initial set of reference customers, we want the sales force to go out and find as many additional customers in that market as possible. Let's get back to the concept of providing context to the product teams. For a product team to be empowered and act with any meaningful degree of autonomy, the team must have a deep understanding of the broader context. This starts with a clear and compelling product vision, and the path to achieving that vision is the product strategy. The more product teams you have, the more essential it is to have this unifying vision and strategy for each team to be able to make good choices. And, just to be clear, the idea is not that every product team has its own product vision. That would miss the point. The idea is that our organization has a product vision, and all the product teams in that organization are helping to contribute to making that vision a reality.
In very large organizations, while the mission statement might apply to the full company, it's likely that each business unit would have its own product vision and strategy.
The difference between vision and strategy is analogous to the difference between good leadership and good management. Leadership inspires and sets the direction, and management helps get us there. Most important, the product vision should be inspiring, and the product strategy should be focused. Prioritizing markets. In terms of prioritizing markets, all I said above was to prioritize your markets and focus on them one at a time. I didn't say how to prioritize them. There is no one right way to do this, but there are three critical inputs to your decision. The first is market sizing, typically referred to as total addressable market, TAM. All things considered equal, we like big markets rather than small markets. But of course, they are not equal. If the largest market would require 2 years of product work, yet several of the somewhat smaller but still significant markets are much closer in terms of time to market, most likely everyone in your company from the CEO and head of sales on down would prefer you to deliver on a smaller market sooner. The second factor concerns distribution, usually referred to as go-to-market, GTM. Different markets may require different sales channels and go-to-market strategies. Again, even if the market is larger, if that market would require a new sales channel, then most likely we would all prioritize a somewhat smaller market that can leverage our existing sales channels. The third factor is a very rough estimation of how long it will take, referred to as time to market, TTM. These are typically the three dominant factors for prioritizing your markets. But others can be important also. I typically suggest that the head of product, head of technology, and head of product marketing sit down together to work out your product strategy, balancing these various factors. Chapter 25, Principles of Product Vision. These are the 10 key principles for coming up with an effective product vision. 1. Start with why. This is coincidentally the name of a great book on the value of product vision by Simon Sinek. The central notion here is to use the product vision to articulate your purpose. Everything follows from that. 2. Fall in love with the problem, not with the solution. I hope you've heard this before, as it's been said many times in many ways by many people. But it's very true and something a great many product people struggle with. 3. Don't be afraid to think big with vision. Too often I see product visions that are not nearly ambitious enough, the kind of thing we can pull off in 6 months to a year or so, and not substantial enough to inspire anyone. 4. Don't be afraid to disrupt yourselves, because if you don't, someone else will. So many companies focus their efforts on protecting what they have rather than constantly creating new value for their customers. 5. The product vision needs to inspire. Remember that we need product teams of missionaries, not mercenaries. More than anything else, it is the product vision that will inspire missionary-like passion in the organization. Create something you can get excited about. You can make any product vision meaningful if you focus on how you genuinely help your users and customers. 6. Determine and embrace relevant and meaningful trends. Too many companies ignore important trends for far too long. It is not very hard to identify the important trends. What's hard is to help the organization understand how those trends can be leveraged by your products to solve customer problems in new and better ways. 7. Skate to where the puck is heading, not to where it was. An important element to product vision is identifying the things that are changing, as well as the things that likely won't be changing, in the time frame of the product vision. Some product visions are wildly optimistic and unrealistic about how fast things will change, and others are far too conservative. This is usually the most difficult aspect of a good product vision. 8. Be stubborn on vision, but flexible on the details. This Jeff Bezos line is very important. So many teams give up on their product vision far too soon. This is usually called a vision pivot, but mostly it's a sign of a weak product organization.
It is never easy, so prepare yourself for that.
But also be careful you don't get attached to details. It is very possible that you may have to adjust course to reach your desired destination. That's called a discovery pivot, and there's nothing wrong with that. 9. Realize that any product vision is a leap of faith. If you could truly validate a vision, then your vision probably isn't ambitious enough. It will take several years to know. So make sure what you're working on is meaningful and recruit people to the product teams who also feel passionate about this problem and then be willing to work for several years to realize the vision. 10. Evangelize continuously and relentlessly. There is no such thing as over-communicating when it comes to explaining and selling the vision. Especially in larger organizations, there is simply no escaping the need for near-constant evangelization. You'll find that people in all corners of the company will at random times get nervous or scared about something they see or hear. Quickly reassure them before their fear infects others. Chapter 26, Principles of Product Strategy. As we discussed previously, there are any number of approaches to product strategy, but good strategies have these 5 principles in common. 1. Focus on one target market or persona at a time. Don't try to please everyone in a single release. Focus on one new target market or one new target persona for each release. You'll find that the product will still likely be useful to others, but at least it will be loved by some, and that's key. 2. Product strategy needs to be aligned with business strategy. The vision is meant to inspire the organization, but the organization ultimately is there to come up with solutions that deliver on the business strategy. So, for example, if that business strategy involves a change in monetization strategy or business model, then the product strategy needs to be aligned with this. 3. Product strategy needs to be aligned with sales and go-to-market strategy. Similarly, if we have a new sales and marketing channel, we need to ensure that our product strategy is aligned with that new channel. A new sales channel or go-to-market strategy can have far-reaching impact on a product. 4. Obsess over customers, not over competitors. Too many companies completely forget about their product strategy once they encounter a serious competitor. They panic and they find themselves chasing the competitor's actions and no longer focusing on their customers. We can't ignore the market, but remember that customers rarely leave us for our competitors. They leave us because we stop taking care of them. 5. Communicate the strategy across the organization. This is part of evangelizing the vision. It's important that all key business partners in the company know the customers we're focused on now and which are planned for later. Stay especially closely synced with sales, marketing, finance, and service. Chapter 27, Product Principles. I always like to complement the product vision and product strategy with a set of product principles. Where the product vision describes the future you want to create, and the product strategy describes your path to achieving that vision, the product principles speak to the nature of the products you want to create. Product principles are not a list of features, and they are not tied to any one product release. The principles are aligned with the product vision for an entire product line. A good set of principles may inspire some product features, but it's more about what the company and product teams believe is important. As an example, early on at eBay, we found that we needed a product principle that spoke to the relationship between buyers and sellers. Most of the revenue came from sellers, so we had a strong incentive to find ways to please sellers. But we soon realized that the real reason sellers loved us was because we provided them with buyers. This realization led to a critical principle that stated, in cases where the needs of the buyers and the sellers conflict, we will prioritize the needs of the buyer, because that's actually the most important thing we can do for sellers. These are what principles are all about. You can imagine how this type of principle would help with designing and building a marketplace, and how many issues could be resolved by simply keeping it in mind. Whether you choose to go public with your principles depends on your purpose. In many cases, the principles are simply a tool for the product teams. But in other cases, the principles serve as a clear statement of what you believe, intended for your users, customers, partners, suppliers, investors, and your employees. Product objectives. Overview. I was extremely fortunate to have started my career at HP as an engineer during their heyday, when they were known as the industry's most successful and enduring example of consistent innovation and execution. As part of HP's internal engineering management training program called the HP Way, I was introduced to a business objective-based system known as MBO, Management by Objectives. Dave Packard claimed, "No tool has contributed more to Hewlett-Packard's success. MBO is the antithesis of management by control." The MBO system was refined and improved at several companies over the years, most notably by the legendary Andy Grove at Intel. Today, the primary business objective management system we use is known as the OKR system, Objectives and Key Results. John Doerr brought the technique from Intel to a very young Google, and a couple decades after Dave Packard attributed much of HP's success to MBO, Larry Page said essentially the same thing about the importance of the OKR process on Google's success. The concept is straightforward and based on two fundamental principles. The first can easily be summed up with the famous General George Patton quote I mentioned earlier. "Never tell people how to do things, tell them what to do, and they will surprise you with their ingenuity." Two, the second was captured by HP's tagline of that era, "When performance is measured by results." The idea here is that you can release all the features you want, but if it doesn't solve the underlying business problem, you haven't really solved anything. The first principle is fundamentally about how to empower and motivate people to get them to do their best work, and the second is about how to meaningfully measure progress. So much has changed in our industry over the years, but these two fundamental management principles are still at the foundation of how the best tech companies and teams operate. While there are several workable systems and tools for managing these business objectives, in this book, I'll focus on the OKR system technique. Most of the major successful tech companies have been using it for several years now. It seems to have hit some sort of tipping point and is now spreading globally. While the concept of team objectives might sound straightforward, there are many ways to institutionalize this across product teams and organizations, and it can take a few quarters before the organization finds its groove. Chapter 28, The OKR Technique. The Objectives and Key Results, OKR, technique is a tool for management, focus, and alignment. As with any tool, there are many ways to use it. Here are the critical points for you to keep in mind when using the tool for product teams in product organizations. 1. Objectives should be qualitative. Key results need to be quantitative, measurable. 2. Key results should be a measure of business results, not output or tasks. 3. The rest of the company will use OKRs a bit differently, but for the product management, design, and technology organization, focus on the organization's objectives and the objectives for each product team, which are designed to roll up and achieve the organization's objectives. Don't let personal objectives or functional team objectives dilute or confuse the focus. 4. Find a good cadence for your organization, typically annually for an organization's objectives and quarterly for a team's objectives. 5. Keep the number of objectives and key results for the organization and for each team small. 1 to 3 objectives with 1 to 3 key results each is typical. 6. It's critical that every product team track their active progress against their objectives, which is typically weekly. 7. The objectives do not need to cover every little thing the team does, but they should cover what the team needs to accomplish. 8. It's important that, one way or another, teams feel accountable to achieving their objectives. If they fail substantially, it's worth having a postmortem retrospective with some of their peers or management. 9. Agree as an organization on how you will be evaluating or scoring your key results. There are different approaches to this, and it's in large part a reflection of your particular company culture. What's important here is consistency across the organization, so that teams know when they can depend on one another. It's common to define a score of 0 on a scale of 0 to 1.0 if you essentially make no progress, 0.3 if you just did the bare minimum, what you know you can achieve, 0.7 if you've accomplished more than the minimum and have really done what you'd hoped you would achieve, and 1.0 if you've really surprised yourselves and others with a truly exceptional result beyond what people were even hoping for. 10. Establish very clear and consistent ways to indicate when a key result is in reality a high integrity commitment described earlier, rather than a normal objective. In other words, for most key results, you may be shooting for that 0.7 score. But for a high integrity commitment, these are special and it's more binary. You either delivered what you promised or you didn't. 11. Be very transparent across the product and technology organization on what objectives each product team is working on and their current progress. 12. Senior management, CEO and executive team, is responsible for the organization's objectives and key results. The heads of product and technology are responsible for the product team objectives and ensuring they deliver on the organization's objectives. The individual product teams are responsible for proposing the key results for each objective they've been assigned. It is normal to have a give-and-take process each quarter as the OKRs are finalized for each team and for the organization. Chapter 29, Product Team Objectives. The OKR technique has enjoyed considerable success, especially inside technology product organizations, from large to small. And there have been some very important lessons learned as teams and organizations work to improve their ability to execute. OKRs are a very general tool that can be used by anyone in the organization, in any role, or even for your use in your personal life. However, as with any tool, some ways of applying them are better than others. Throughout this book, I emphasize the importance of a product team. Recall that a product team is a cross-functional set of professionals, typically comprised of a product manager, a product designer, and a small number of engineers. In addition, there are sometimes additional people with specialized skills included on the team, such as a data analyst, a user researcher, or a test automation engineer. Also recall that each product team typically is responsible for some significant part of the company's product offering or technology. For example, one product team might be responsible for mobile apps for drivers, another for mobile apps for riders, another might be responsible for secure payment handling, and so on. The key is that these people, with their different skill sets, usually come from different functional departments in the company, but they sit and work all day, every day, with their cross-functional team to solve hard business and technology problems. It's not unusual in larger organizations to have on the order of 20 to 50 of these cross-functional product teams, each responsible for different areas, and each product team with its own objectives to work on.
For companies using the OKR system, the problems these teams are asked to tackle are, as you might expect, communicated and tracked through the product team's OKRs.
The OKRs also help to ensure that each team is aligned with the objectives of the company. Moreover, as an organization scales, OKRs become an increasingly necessary tool for ensuring that each product team understands how they are contributing to the greater whole, coordinating work across teams, and avoiding duplicate work. The reason this is so important to understand is that when organizations first start with OKRs, there's a common tendency to have each functional department create their own OKRs for their own organization. For example, the design department might have objectives related to moving to a responsive design. The engineering department might have objectives related to improving the scalability and performance of the architecture. And the quality department might have objectives relating to the test and release automation. The problem is that the individual members of each of these functional departments are the actual members of a cross-functional product team. The product team has business-related objectives, for example, to reduce the customer acquisition cost, to increase the number of daily active users, or to reduce the time to onboard a new customer. But each person on the team may have their own set of objectives that cascade down through their functional manager. Imagine if the engineers were told to spend their time on replatforming, the designers on moving to a responsive design, and QA on retooling. While each of these may be worthy activities, the chances of solving the business problems that the cross-functional teams were created to solve are not high. What all too often happens in this case is that the people on the product teams are conflicted as to where they should be spending their time. This results in confusion, frustration, and disappointing results from leadership and individual contributors alike. But this is easily avoided. If you deploy OKRs for your product organization, the key is to focus your OKRs at the product team level. This means don't let functional team or individual person OKRs confuse the issue.
Focus the attention of the individuals on their product team objectives.
If different functional organizations, such as design, engineering, or quality assurance, have larger objectives, such as responsive design, technical debt, and test automation, they should be discussed and prioritized at the leadership team level along with the other business objectives, and then incorporated into the relevant product team's objectives. Note that it's not a problem for managers of the functional areas to have individual objectives relating to their organization. This is because these people aren't conflicted, as they're not normally serving on a product team. For example, the head of UX design might be responsible for a strategy for migrating to a responsive design. The head of engineering might be responsible for delivering a strategy around managing technical debt. The head of product management might be responsible for delivering a product vision, or the head of QA might be responsible for selecting a test automation tool. It's also not normally a big problem if individual contributors, such as a particular engineer, designer, or product manager, has a small number of personal growth-related objectives, such as improving their knowledge of a particular technology. This assumes the individual isn't committing to a burden that will interfere with their ability to contribute their part to their product team, which of course is their primary responsibility. The key is that the cascading of OKRs in a product organization needs to be up from the cross-functional product teams to the company or business unit level. Product at scale. Overview. We have thus far discussed product vision, strategy, and business objectives. In truth, as an early stage startup, you can survive without any of these for a while. It's amazing how far you can get by focusing on meeting the needs of some early customers. However, the need for this vision and business objective context becomes truly serious at scale. Keeping a small number of teams and their engineers doing useful stuff is not very hard, but getting good results out of a medium or especially large organization can be truly challenging. Realize also that by the time the company is scaled, the original co-founders may have moved on, so there may very well be a void. Teams need this context. It is nearly impossible for them to make good decisions and do good work without it. The main ways these issues show up is in diminished morale, lack of innovation, and reduced velocity. Chapter 30, Product Objectives at Scale. The OKR system is very scalable. I would argue some sort of tool for managing and aligning work is critical to scaling effectively. But it's also true that many companies do struggle with scaling their use of OKRs. In this chapter, I shine a light on what needs to change as you use the OKR system at scale. Remember that I'm just talking about the product and technology organization here, product management, user experience design, and engineering. And while you can use the techniques I'm about to describe at any scale, I am focused here on growth stage or enterprise organizations. 1. With startups or small organizations, when everyone essentially knows what everyone else is doing and why, it's normal for each product team to propose their objectives and key results. There's some amount of give and take, and then people get to work. With larger organizations, product teams need more help. The first help they need is a very clear understanding of the organization-level objectives. Let's say that the top two objectives for the company are to improve customer lifetime value and expand globally. Let's also say that you have on the order of 25 product teams. All the product teams likely have thoughts on both of these organizational objectives, but clearly the company will need to be smart about which teams pursue each objective. Some teams might focus on only one, others might contribute to both, and yet other teams might be tackling critical work beyond those two objectives. Leadership, especially the head of product, head of technology, and head of design, will need to discuss the company objectives and which teams are best suited to pursue each objective. 2. Moreover, at scale, it is very common to have some significant number of product teams that are there in support of the other product teams. These are often called platform product teams or shared services product teams. They are very high leverage, but they are a little different in that they generally don't directly serve customers. They serve customers indirectly, usually through the higher level, solution-focused product teams. These platform teams will get requests from most or even all the higher level product teams, and they are there to help them succeed. But again, leadership will need to help coordinate the objectives for these teams and make sure we coordinate the dependencies and align the interests. 3. Once you have your objectives, there is a very critical reconciliation process in which the leadership team looks at the proposed key results from the product teams and identifies gaps and then looks to what might be adjusted to cover those gaps. For example, enlisting the help of additional teams or reviewing the priority of the work. 4. At scale, it's much harder to know what product teams are working on, which objectives, and the progress they are making. There are now a variety of online tools that help organizations make the objectives transparent to the organization. But even with these tools, we lean on management to help connect the dots between teams. 5. The larger the organization, the longer the list of high-integrity commitments that are needed, and the more actively they need to be managed and tracked. Delivery managers play a key role in tracking and managing these dependencies and our commitments. 6. In many enterprise-scale organizations, there are essentially multiple business units, and in this case, we would expect that there are corporate-level OKRs, but there would also be business unit-level OKRs, and the product teams would roll up into those. In summary, when using OKRs at scale, there is a larger burden on leadership and management to ensure that the organization is truly aligned, that each and every product team understands how they fit into the mix and what they are there to contribute. Chapter 31,
Product Evangelism.
Product evangelism is, as Guy Kawasaki put it years ago, selling the dream. It's helping people imagine the future and inspiring them to help create that future. If you're a startup founder, CEO, or a head of product, this is a very big part of your job, and you'll have a hard time assembling a strong team if you don't get good at it. If you're a product manager, especially at a large company, and you're not good at evangelism, there's a very strong chance that your product efforts will get derailed before they see the light of day. And even if product does manage to ship, it will likely go the way of thousands of other large company efforts and wither on the vine. We've talked about how important it is to have a team of missionaries, not mercenaries, and evangelism is a key responsibility to make this happen. The responsibility for this falls primarily on the product manager. There are several techniques to help communicate the value of what you're proposing to your team, colleagues, stakeholders, executives, and investors. Here are my top 10 pieces of advice for product managers to sell the dream. 1. Use a prototype. For many people, it's way too hard to see the forest through the trees. When all you have is a bunch of user stories, it can be difficult to see the big picture and how things hang together, or even if they hang together. A prototype lets them clearly see the forest and the trees. 2. Share the pain. Show the team the customer pain you are addressing. This is why I love to bring engineers along for customer visits and meetings. For many people, they have to see or experience the pain themselves to get it. 3. Share the vision. Make sure you have a very clear understanding of your product vision, product strategy, and product principles. Show how your work contributes to this vision and is true to the principles. 4. Share learnings generously. After every user test or customer visit, share your learnings. Not just the things that went well, but share the problems too. Give your team the information they need to help come up with a solution. 5. Share credit generously. Make sure the team views it as their product, not just your product. However, when things don't go well, step forward and take responsibility for the miss and show the team you're learning from the mistakes as well. They'll respect you for it. 6. Learn how to give a great demo. This is an especially important skill to use with customers and key execs. We are not trying to teach them how to operate the product, and we're not trying to do a user test on them. We're trying to show them the value of what we're building. A demo is not training, and it's not a test. It's a persuasive tool. Get really, really good at it. 7. Do your homework. Your team and your stakeholders will all be much more likely to follow you if they believe you know what you're talking about. Be the undisputed expert on your users and customers, and be the undisputed expert on your market, including your competitors and the relevant trends. 8. Be genuinely excited. If you're not excited about your product, you should probably fix that, either by changing what you work on or by changing your role. 9. Learn to show some enthusiasm. Assuming you're genuinely excited, it's amazing to me how many product managers are so bad or so uncomfortable at showing enthusiasm. This matters a lot. Absolutely be sincere, but let people see you're genuinely excited. Enthusiasm really is contagious. 10. Spend time with your team. If you're not spending significant face time with your designer and every engineer on your team, then they can't see the enthusiasm in your eyes. If your team is not co-located, you'll need to make a special effort to travel there and do this at least every couple months. Spending some personal time with every last person on the team pays off big in their level of motivation and, as a result, in the velocity of the team. It's worth your time. If your company is mid-sized to large, then it's normal to have product marketing play the role of evangelist with your customers and your sales force. You still may be called on to help out on the big deals and partnerships, but you'll need to focus your evangelism on your team because the best thing you can do for your customers is to provide them with a great product. Chapter 32. Profile. Alex Pressland of the BBC. I have to admit, I have a soft spot for the BBC. They've been around for nearly 100 years, but they embraced technology and the internet relatively early. I've seen so many amazing product people come out of the BBC, and many are now spread across Europe and beyond. Back in 2003, a full 4 years before the debut of the iPhone, a young product manager at the BBC, Alex Pressland, had just finished leading a product effort that enabled the BBC to be one of the first media companies in the world to syndicate content. Most people at the BBC had no idea why this was important or even desirable, but Alex understood that this enabling technology could be used in new and unanticipated ways to increase the BBC's reach, a major part of the institution's mission. Because Alex understood the potential for IP-based syndicated content technology, she started searching for new and useful ways to put this technology to use. She began by looking at people in the United Kingdom who were not being reached by the BBC's conventional broadcast media, TVs and radios in homes and cars. One early use she identified was large electronic billboard screens in many city center venues that were capable of displaying video. But she observed that these venues were just playing the same thing you could watch on your television at home, even though the context and audience was very different. So, Alex proposed a series of experiments in which she would have editorial teams assemble specific tailored content suitable for specific venues and audiences. And then she would measure the audience reach and engagement. While this might sound obvious today, at the time, this was a very foreign concept to the BBC's broadcast journalism culture. There was a long list of obstacles in trying to push the BBC in this direction, not the least of which was editorial and legal. Editorial wasn't used to the model in which content would be created and then delivered in different contexts. This gets to the heart of the BBC editorial culture and required considerable persuasion to show why this was a very good thing for both the BBC and for the audience. Legal wasn't used to distribution via IP-enabled devices. Imagine the stack of content licensing agreements that would need to be updated or renegotiated. The results of Alex's experiments and early successes, however, gave her the confidence to propose to BBC leadership a new product vision and strategy which she called BBC Out of Home. It's important to note that she did this as an individual contributor product manager. This work ended up fueling a dramatic shift at the BBC, from broadcast content to content distribution. And this work dramatically affected reach and soon became the basis for BBC's mobile efforts.
Today, more than 50 million people around the world depend on BBC's mobile offerings every week.
This is not just a story about applying technology to solve problems. It's also a story about the power of force of will. With large enterprise companies, it's never easy to drive substantial change. But this is exactly what strong product managers figure out how to do. Alex went on from the BBC to have a terrific career at several tech and media companies and now is a product leader in New York. Part 4, The Right Process. We've explored product teams in Part 2, and we described how we decide what each team needs to focus on in Part 3. In Part 4, I explain how product teams do their job. We'll work through the techniques, activities, and best practices used to repeatedly discover and deliver successful products. Even though this part is titled The Right Process, I hope you'll soon realize that the right process is not any single process. Rather, it's more accurately described as a combination of techniques, mindset, and culture. I mostly emphasize discovery techniques, as our focus is on product managers, and that is their primary responsibility. The bulk of the product manager's time needs to be focused on working with her product team, with her key stakeholders, and with her customers to discover solutions that her customers love and that work for the business. Keep in mind, however, that the product manager and product designer do need to ensure that they're available to answer questions from the engineers that arise during delivery activities. Normally, answering these delivery questions is on the order of half an hour to an hour of time per day. Product discovery. Overview. Most of us are working on solving some pretty hard problems, and it usually ends up taking some fairly complex systems to power these solutions. For most teams, there are two very significant challenges to tackle. First, discovering in detail what the customer solution needs to be. That includes everything from making sure there are enough customers that even need this solution, the demand, and then coming up with a solution that works for our customers and for our business. Even harder, we need to make sure we come up with a single solution that works for many customers and not a series of specials. To do this, we need to be able to test out many ideas, and we need to do this quickly and inexpensively. Second, we need to ensure we deliver a robust and scalable implementation that our customers can depend on for consistently reliable value. Your team needs to be able to release with confidence. While you'll never have 100% confidence, you should not have to release and pray. So, we need to learn fast, yet also release with confidence. It's understandable that many people might naturally view these two difficult goals as at odds with each other. We are in a big hurry to push something out, to learn what works and what doesn't. Yet, we don't want to release something that's not ready for prime time and risk hurting our customers and damaging our brand. I spend a lot of my time visiting with product teams. I have, on occasion, been called out for pushing hard 1 minute for the team to be much more aggressive in getting out to customers and getting early feedback on their ideas, and then just minutes later pushing that same team hard not to compromise their standards on releasing scalable, fault-tolerant, reliable, high-performance, secure software. You might also recognize this problem in another guise. Many teams get into a lot of grief with the concept of a minimum viable product, MVP, because on the one hand, we are very motivated to get this out in front of customers fast to get feedback and learn. And on the other hand, when we do get out there fast, people feel like this so-called product is an embarrassment to the brand and the company. How could we possibly consider launching this? In this section, I clarify how strong teams work to meet these dual and simultaneous objectives of rapid learning and discovery, yet building stable and solid releases in delivery. In general, I find that most product teams have a much better sense of how to accomplish the second goal of delivering solid software than how to accomplish the first goal of rapid experimentation and discovery. Continuous delivery is a good example of an advanced delivery technique I find in teams that understand the importance of a series of small, incremental changes to a complex system. Part of what causes confusion is a dilution of what is really meant when we call something a product, or product quality, or productized, or live in production. I always try hard to reserve the term product to describe the state at which we can run a business on it. Specifically, it is scalable and performant to the degree necessary. It has a strong suite of automated regression tests. It is instrumented to collect the necessary analytics. It has been internationalized and localized where appropriate. It is maintainable. It is consistent with the brand promise. And most important, it is something the team can release with confidence. This is not easy. It's where most of the time goes when our engineers are building. As such, we try very hard not to waste this effort. Doing all this work when the product manager isn't even sure this is the solution the customer wants or needs is a recipe for product failure and big waste. So, the purpose of product discovery is to make sure we have some evidence that when we ask the engineers to build a production quality product, it won't be a wasted effort. And this is why we have so many different techniques in product discovery. We've got techniques for getting a much deeper understanding of our users and customers, and for validating product ideas both qualitatively and quantitatively. And, in fact, most of the techniques don't require the developer's time, which is important because we appreciate how much time and effort needs to go into creating production quality software in delivery. Much of the key to effective product discovery is getting access to our customers without trying to push our quick experiments into production. If you are an early stage startup and you have no customers, then of course this is not really an issue, and it's very likely premature to even be creating production quality software. But for most of us, we have real customers and real revenue, so we do have to care about this. Later in this section, we'll talk about the techniques that allow for rapid experimentation in a responsible way in larger enterprise companies. But here's the key. If you want to discover great products, it really is essential that you get your ideas in front of real users and customers early and often. If you want to deliver great products, you want to use best practices for engineering and try not to override the engineer's concerns. Chapter 33, Principles of Product Discovery. The purpose of product discovery is to address these critical risks. Will the customer buy this or choose to use it? Value risk. Can the user figure out how to use it? Usability risk. Can we build it? Feasibility risk. Does this solution work for our business? Business viability risk. And it's not enough that it's just the product manager's opinion on these questions. We need to collect evidence. When it comes to how we do product discovery, there are a set of core principles that drive how we work. If you understand these, you will understand not only how to work well today, but also how to easily incorporate new techniques as they emerge in the future. 1. We know we can't count on our customers or our executives or stakeholders to tell us what to build. Customers don't know what's possible, and with technology products, none of us know what we really want until we actually see it. It's not that customers or our executives are necessarily wrong. It's just that it's our job to make sure the solution we deliver solves the underlying problem. This is probably the most fundamental principle in all of modern product. Historically, in the vast majority of innovations in our industry, the customers had no idea that what they now love was even a possibility. This is only becoming truer with time. 2. The most important thing is to establish compelling value. It's all hard, but the hardest part of all is creating the necessary value so that customers ultimately choose to buy or to use. We can survive for a while with usability issues or performance issues, but without the core value, we really have nothing. As a result, this is generally where we'll need to spend most of our discovery time. 3. As hard and important as the engineering is, coming up with a good user experience is usually even harder and more critical to success. While every product team has engineers, not every team has the necessary product design skills, and even when they do, are they being used the way we need to use them? 4. Functionality, design, and technology are inherently intertwined. In the old waterfall model, the market drove the functionality, also known as the requirements, which drove the design, which drove the implementation. Today, we know that the technology drives and enables the functionality as much as the other way around. We know that technology drives and enables design. We know that design drives and enables functionality. You don't have to look further than your own phone to see numerous examples of both. The point is that all three of these are completely intertwined. This is the single biggest reason we push so hard